plane and end the program. Some of our friends in Congress, like Senator John Glenn, were bitter about the decision after a 2-year struggle to keep it from happening. Senator Glenn warned, "The termination of the SR-71 is a grave mistake and can place our nation at a serious disadvantage in the event of a future crisis." We had more than 40 members of Congress actively seeking to keep the program alive, headed by Senator Sam Nunn, the powerful chairman of the Senate Committee on Armed Services. But Cheney prevailed. I was a fan of his, thought he was an outstanding DOD secretary, but I agreed with Admiral Bobby Inman, then the former director of the National Security Agency, who commiserated with me over Cheney's decision. "Satellites will never fully compensate for the loss of the Blackbird," Bobby told me. "They have nothing in the wings to replace it, and we may be in for some nasty surprises and a whole new set of intelligence problems because of this." A few days after Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, I called General Michael Low, Air Force Vice Chief of Staff, and told him that I could have 3 Blackbirds ready and operational in 90 days to overfly the region. I also could supply qualified pilots. The last 3 Blackbirds were being used by NASA for high-altitude flight tests. My idea was to provide the Blue Suiters with a total package: airplanes, pilots, and ground crews for a cost of about $100 million. The airplanes would be indispensable, providing surveillance over Iraq. And I had another idea, too. "General," I said, "we could fly over the rooftops of Baghdad at Mach 3+ at prayer time, and sonic boom the bastards. Just think how demoralizing that would be for Saddam." General Lowe said he would get back to me. About a week later, I received a call saying that Dick Cheney had vetoed the idea. The secretary felt that there was no such thing as a one-time-only role for the Blackbird. "Once we let this damned airplane back in, we'll never get it back out," he told General Lowe. Other voices. Ed Yielding, Air Force pilot. When Congress approved the decision to retire the SR-71, the Smithsonian Institution requested that a Blackbird be delivered for eventual display in the Air and Space Museum in Washington, and that we set a new transcontinental speed record delivering it from California to Dulles. I had the honor of piloting that final flight on March 6, 1990, for its final 2,300-mile flight between L.A. and D.C. I took off with my backseat navigator, Lieutenant Colonel Joe Vita, at 4:30 in the morning from Palmdale, just outside L.A., and despite the early hour, a huge crowd cheered us off. We hit a tanker over the Pacific, then turned and dashed east, accelerating to 2.6 Mach and about 60,000 feet. Below stretched hundreds of miles of California coastline in the early morning light. In the east and above, the hint of a red sunrise and the bright twinkling lights from Venus, Mars, and Saturn. A moment later, we were directly over Central California, with the Blackbird's continual sonic boom serving as an early wake-up call to the millions sleeping below on this special day. I pushed out to Mach 3.3. From Kansas City eastward, we were high above a cirrus cloud undercast, but savored this view from above 97% of the Earth's atmosphere, enjoyed witnessing for one final time the curvature of the Earth, the bright blue glow just above the horizon, and the pitch-dark daytime sky directly overhead. High above the jet stream, the winds blew at only 5 miles per hour, and we cruised smooth as silk. We averaged 2,190 miles per hour from St. Louis to Cincinnati, covering the distance in 8 minutes 32 seconds, a new city-to-city aviation record. When we were abeam Washington at 84,000 feet, I terminated the supersonic afterburner and began our descent. We had set 2 records, L.A. to D.C. in only 64 minutes, and Kansas City to D.C. in 26 minutes. And we had set a new transcontinental speed record, covering 2,404 statute miles in only 67 minutes, 54 seconds. It was also the first time that a sonic boom had traversed the entire length of our great country. Through the haze, I saw the Dulles Tower and flew above the waiting crowd at 800 feet, resisting the temptation to really go down on the deck for fear of blowing out the Dulles terminal windows with our powerful engine vibrations. I felt both tremendous elation and tremendous sadness. When we landed and climbed out, Ben Rich, head of the Skunk Works, was waiting below to shake my hand. I had met him once before when I worked with him to plan a flyby of this airplane directly over the Skunk Works on December 20th, 1989, celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Blackbird. I made three low passes over the complex of hangars and buildings that comprised the famous Skunk Works operation at Burbank, and Ben had trotted out every single worker to cheer and experience the thrill of seeing this incredible machine they had built sweeping in low over their heads. There were several thousand workers down below waving at us. On the last pass, I performed a short, steep afterburner climb and rocked my wings in a salute. I heard later that men had cried. 12. The China Syndrome. The most sensitive project during my years at the Skunk Works was begun in 1962 and codenamed Tagboard. Inside the Skunk Works and out, fewer than 100 people were involved or knew about it, even though the program began under President Kennedy and became operational under Richard Nixon. To this day, Tagboard remains mist-shrouded, in part because it was basically a failure. But still, the operations were truly spectacular. Flying spy drones over Communist China's most remote and secret nuclear test facilities. I was fascinated by drones. To me, a remote-controlled or pre-programmed pilotless vehicle was the pragmatic solution to spying over extreme hostile territory without worrying about loss of life or political embarrassments of the Francis Gary Powers variety. If the drone traveled high enough and fast enough, the enemy could not stop it. Indeed, might not even spot it. Several of us in the analytical section were drone boosters and from time to time tried to lobby Kelly Johnson into joining our fan club. But Kelly resisted. Drones, he argued, were too big and complex to be economically feasible or operationally successful. But over the years, he gradually changed his mind. He was aware of the ominous crash development of nuclear and rocket weapons on the Chinese mainland, and the loss of four Taiwanese U-2s shot down while trying to film those sensitive sites. The most significant of these development facilities was Lop Nor, 2,000 miles inland, practically to the Chinese border with Mongolia. Lop Nor was situated inside a 2,000-foot depression 20 miles wide on an otherwise 4,000-foot plateau. This rugged, isolated test facility was the primary target of U.S. intelligence, especially in the face of an aggressive and increasingly hostile Chinese foreign policy. The Chinese had split with Moscow, triggered border clashes with India and Tibet, and were causing major concerns in nearly every foreign capital around the world. Lop Nor was 2,000 miles away and a very tough round trip for even the most experienced U-2 pilot. Those of us promoting the drone idea inside the Skunk Works argued with Kelly that it was the best way to overfly forbidding places like Lop Nor. We envisioned a delivery system where a drone would be piggybacked on top of the Blackbird and launched off the China coast, rocket up to 100,000 feet and zip over Lop Nor at speeds faster than Mach 3, take its pictures, then turn around and fly back to the launch point, where on electronic command it would drop its film package by parachute to a waiting naval frigate in the sea below. The drone would then self-destruct. The technology involved was not only feasible, but within our grasp. Kelly got a negative reception to the drone idea from John Perengoski, who had replaced Dick Bissell at the CIA. The Air Force was only slightly more receptive. Nevertheless, Kelly found an ally in Brigadier General Leo Geary, Director of Special Projects in the Air Force, who coordinated programs between the CIA and the Blue Suiters. Geary obtained $500,000 in seed money from Black Project contingency funds, and we put together a small team to plot and plan a design. I was the propulsion man. "This is a most peculiar situation," Kelly told us. "The agency has turned its back, so Lockheed might wind up launching this damn thing ourselves. I have no instructions from anyone in Washington, but I think I know what they want. We will try to get 6-inch ground resolution photographically, a range of at least 3,000 nautical miles, a camera payload of 425 pounds, and a guidance system of about 400 pounds. We should detach the payload bay holding the camera, film, and guidance system, and float it down by parachute. Make it reusable and save a bundle of money that way. That's it. Go to it. The drone we designed had the flat triangular shape of a manta ray, was 40 feet long, weighed about 17,000 pounds, would be built from titanium, powered by the same kind of Marquardt ramjet we once used for an experimental ground-to-air missile developed in the 1950s, called Bomark. The drone had the lowest radar cross-section of anything we had ever designed, and could cruise faster than 3 times the speed of sound. It was equipped with a Star Tracker inertial guidance system that could be constantly updated via computer feeds from the system aboard the mothership until the moment of launch. The system was fully automated, and the drone's steering was directed by stored signals to its hydraulic servo actuators. It was capable of a sophisticated flight plan, making numerous turns and twists to get where it was going, then repeating them in reverse to return to where it came from. The payload was detached on radio command after the mission and parachuted to a waiting cargo plane, equipped with a Y-shaped catching device. After the nose detached, the drone self-exploded. Kelly took our design to Washington in February 1963. His reception at the CIA was still unenthusiastic, mostly because the agency was already overextended on a huge secret budget for hardware, involving blackbirds and spy satellites and feeling heat from congressional oversight committees. In fact, the Bureau of the Budget was rumored to be taking a hard look at the CIA's air wing, with an eye toward eliminating it entirely, which finally occurred by presidential command in 1966. But Air Force Secretary Harold Brown was definitely interested in the drone concept, as much as for a way of delivering a nuclear bomb as for spying. They could deploy a nuclear weapon by drone 3,000 miles from a hotly defended target and be impossible to stop. Apparently, the CIA got serious about our drone after learning about the Air Force interest. With General Geary acting as our champion, the agency decided to climb on board the drone project. On March 20, 1963, we were awarded a letter contract from the CIA which would share funding and operational responsibilities with the Air Force. Ultimately, we built 50 drones for only $31 million before the project ended in 1971. Tag Board now became the most classified project at the Skunk Works, even more secret than the Blackbird airplanes being assembled. So Kelly decided to wall off a section of the huge assembly building housing Blackbird, which already was as guarded as Fort Knox, to accommodate the new drone project. To get inside that walled-off section required special access passes, and the shop workers immediately dubbed it Berlin Wall West. Unfortunately, I found myself spending more time inside that walled section than I had ever anticipated. But the technical problems were formidable, especially the attempt to launch a piggybacked drone from a mothership launch platform, flying at 3 times the speed of sound. The drone would be sitting toward the top rear of the fuselage on a pylon. Expecting a drone to launch through the mothership's Mach 3 shockwave presented a monumental engineering challenge, and Kelly insisted that we launch at full power. It took us nearly 6 months to work out some of the shockwave and engine problems with models in the wind tunnel, while other problems concerned with perfecting the guidance system, the cameras, the self-destruction system, the parachute deployment system, all loomed before us like monsters let out of some evil sorcerer's dungeon. But to Kelly, the biggest sweat was guaranteeing a safe launch. I had never seen him so spooked. "God damn it, I don't want to lose a pilot and an airplane testing this system. This will be the most dangerous maneuver in any airplane that I've ever worked on. And I don't want that damn drone flying out of control and crashing into the middle of downtown Los Angeles or Portland." He kept postponing test launches and finally aimed for the first one on his birthday, February 27, 1965. But that first flight did not occur until we had solved dozens of complicated problems 13 months later. Bill Park finally took off in a Blackbird from our secret base with a drone sitting on top of his fuselage. Out over the California coast at 80,000 feet and at Mach 3.2, Bill ignited the drone, which launched perfectly, and flew 120 miles out to sea before running out of fuel and crashing. 1 month later, a second launch was spectacularly successful. The drone flew 1,900 nautical miles at Mach 3.3, holding to its course all the way, and finally fell out of the sky when a hydraulic pump burned out. On June 16, 1966, we attempted the third test launch of the drone, piggybacking on an SR-71 Blackbird, a two-seater. Bill Park was our pilot, and in the second cockpit was Ray Torek, the launch operator. The Blackbird took off and headed for the California coast just north of L.A. to launch over the Naval Tracking Station at Point Mugu. The flight was a dandy. The drone flew 1,600 nautical miles, making 8 programmed turns, while taking pictures of the Channel Islands, San Clemente, and Santa Catalina from 92,000 feet at 4,000-plus miles per hour. It did everything but eject the film package due to electronic failure, which was a very fixable problem. So, a few weeks later, on July 30th, 1966, we repeated the same test flight over Point Mugu, just up the coast from Malibu. This time, we launched at 3.25 Mach and catastrophe. The drone crashed into the fuselage of the Blackbird, which spun wildly out of control. Park and Torek both ejected with their pressure suits inflated. Bill Park was picked up in a life raft 150 miles at sea. Torek splashed down nearby, but rashly opened the visor of his helmet while he was paddling in the ocean, so that water flooded into his pressure suit through the neck ring, and he sank like a stone. Our flight director, Keith Beswick, who was flying Chase, had to go to a local mortuary and cut him out of the pressure suit so that the body could be properly prepared for burial. We were shaken, but no one more so than Kelly Johnson, who was so upset at Torek's death that he impulsively and emotionally decided to cancel the entire program and give back the development funding to the Air Force and the agency. Several of us urged him to reconsider. The drone project was actually doing well, but Kelly seemed adamant. "I will not risk any more test pilots or Blackbirds. I don't have either to spare." Kelly could now turn to the SAC B-52 bomber as the vehicle to carry the drone. The B-52 was subsonic, which would decrease the dangers of an air launch, and it could launch our drone from about 45,000 feet, which would not cut very deeply into our bird's extended range. Kelly flew to Washington, and shortly after Christmas 1966, met for over an hour with LBJ's Deputy Defense Secretary, Cyrus Vance, who was enthusiastic about Tag Board and authorized the use of B-52s as the mothership. Vance told Kelly, "We need this project to work because our government will never again allow a Francis Gary Powers situation to develop. All our overflights over denied territory will either be with satellites or drones." The Air Force supplied 2 specially equipped H-model B-52s, an 8-engine mothership that would carry a drone under each wing on a 16.5-hour, 7,000 nautical mile flight from Beale Air Force Base in Central California to a launch point west of the Philippines, over the South China Sea. The drone's mission was to overfly China. It would launch from 40,000 feet and fire its solid propellant booster rocket for 87 seconds, soaring it to 80,000 feet at Mach 3.3+, before falling away. The drone's guidance system would direct its 3,000-mile journey. On the return leg of the mission, the drone was programmed to descend to 60,000 feet and slow to Mach 1.6 before automatically ejecting a hatch containing its film, camera, and expensive telemetry and flight control components, which could be used again after successful parachute recovery. By the winter of 1968, the Skunk Works and the Air Force teamed up to launch long-range test flights using the mighty B-52, which carried 2 drones, one under each wing, for a total carrying payload of 24 tons. The tests were conducted in Hawaii with the drones launched thousands of miles across the open Pacific, overflying such places as Christmas Island or Midway, taking pictures of pre-programmed targets on these islands, then looping back toward Hawaii and culminating 3,000 miles of precise flying with a rendezvous point above a recovery team of picket ships and cargo planes. Our track record on these so-called Captain Hook test flights was 5 successes and 2 failures over 14 months. And by the fall of 1969, a special committee of CIA and Air Force analysts began recommending hot missions to the XCOM, Executive Committee of the National Security Council. XCOM approved and forwarded its recommendation to President Nixon. We received a go for a first mission over Lop Nor nuclear test range on November 9, 1969. A lone B-52 took off from Beale Air Force Base in the pre-dawn hours, carrying 2 tag-board drones, one under each wing in case one failed to ignite. After a single air-to-air refueling some 12 hours later, it reached its launch point at the 14-hour mark, and Tagboard successfully fired beyond range of Chinese early warning radar nets. The next day, Kelly told us, "Well, the damn thing came out of China but was lost. It wasn't spotted or shot down, but it must have malfunctioned and crashed on us." Those monitoring the flight said Chinese radar never detected it, so we concluded the guidance had screwed up and the drone just kept on chugging until it ran out of gas, probably after crossing the Sino-Soviet border into Siberia. About 11 months later, the Nixon White House again approved a flight against Lop Nor. This time, the drone performed the mission perfectly, arriving back right on rendezvous point, but after dropping its camera and photo package, the chute failed to open, and the package plummeted into the sea and was lost. In March 1971, Nixon approved a third flight over the same area. This one also functioned perfectly. The drone separated its camera package on schedule and it parachuted into the sea, where a Navy frigate was on station awaiting a pickup. Unfortunately, the seas were heavy, and the Navy botched the recovery, allowing the package to be pulled beneath the ship with the parachute on one side and the hatch on the other. The package sank before they could get cables around it. The final flight occurred 2 weeks later. This time our bird was tracked 1,900 miles into China and then disappeared from the screen. The reason was never determined. No other flights were attempted. The complex logistics surrounding each flight, involving recovery ships and rendezvous aircraft, cost a bloody fortune to stage. We were canceled in mid-1972. And Kelly was bitter about it. "I'm not one to find scapegoats," he told me at the time. "But one reason why we had failures over China is that the birds we used had been stored up at Beale Air Force Base for 9 months before the missions were authorized. The Blue Suitors had 160 people there assigned to this program. Each of them had a salary to justify and took our drone apart frequently after our final checkouts here just to put it back together again. And by so doing, they screwed up the works. We should have had the Skunk Works doing complete field service and even fly the actual missions and launch those birds. I'm telling you, Ben, that would have made all the difference in the world." The end came in the form of a Defense Department telegram to Kelly on July 8, 1971, informing him the tag board had been canceled and ordering him to destroy all of its tooling. Still, we felt pride in the high degree of performance obtained for such a low cost. On a February day 15 years later, a CIA operative came to see me at the Skunk Works carrying a panel, which he plopped down on my desk. "Ben, do you recognize this?" I grinned. "Sure I do. Where did you get it?" The CIA guy laughed. "Believe it or not, I got it as a Christmas gift from a Soviet KGB agent. He told me this piece was found by a shepherd in Soviet Siberia." Actually, it was from the first D-21 mission into China in November 1969, when the drone flew off course into Soviet Siberia before running out of fuel. The panel was from the drone's engine mount. It was made from composite material loaded for radar absorption and looked as if it had been made just yesterday. The Russians mistakenly believed that this generation-old panel signified our current stealth technology. It was, in a way, a very nice tribute to our work on Tagboard. 13. The Ship That Never Was. In the spring of 1978, while we were developing our model for the first stealth airplane, Our project photographer stopped me in the hall to complain about defects in a new Polaroid camera we had recently purchased. I've been taking instant view shots of the stealth model, and I'm getting very fuzzy pictures. I think I've got a defective lens, he remarked. I slapped my head, knowing we had accidentally stumbled onto an exciting development. Time out. There isn't a damn thing wrong with your new camera, I insisted. Polaroid uses a sound echo device like sonar to focus, and you are getting fuzzy pictures because our stealthy coatings and shaping on that model are interfering with the sound echo. I was always on the prowl, looking for new ideas to expand or exploit technologies we were developing. A stealth airplane was our goal. But how about a stealthy submarine that would be undetectable on sonar? If we had avoided the sonar device built into a Polaroid camera, why couldn't we avoid sonar returns against submarines, or even surface ships specially treated and shaped to escape detection? I had a couple of our engineers buy a small model submarine, put faceted fairings on it, and test it in a sonic chamber. Even with such a crude test setup, we discovered that we had reduced the sonar return from that model sub by three orders of magnitude. In the engineering game, improving anything by a single order of magnitude, 10 times better, is a very big deal, usually worth a nice bonus or at least a bottle of champagne. 3 orders of magnitude is 1,000 times better. That's worth a fortune, a medal, or both, but is as rare an occurrence as an astronomer discovering a new constellation. So we decided to design a stealthy sub. The cigar-shaped hull was shielded by an outer wall of flat, angular surfaces that would bounce sonar signals away and also muffle the engine sounds and the internal noises of crewmen inside the vessel. We ran numerous acoustical tests in special sound measuring facilities and obtained dramatic improvements. If nothing else, we had rendered null and void the favorite cliché of a lot of World War II naval action movies about a submariner sneezing or dropping a monkey wrench at the critical moment when the enemy destroyer's sonar search pings ever closer. The flat outer wall effectively eliminated any noises. Armed with high hopes, I took our design and test results to the Pentagon office of a Navy captain in charge of submarine R&D. By the time I left his office, I was grimly reciting Kelly's Skunk Works Rule Number 15. 14 of his basic rules for operating a Skunk Works had been written out, but the 15th was known only by word of mouth. Verbal wisdom passed on from one generation of employees to the next. Starve before doing business with the damned Navy. They don't know what in hell they want, and will drive you up a wall before they break either your heart or a more exposed part of your anatomy. I've been a fool to ignore Kelly's wise words of warning. That submarine captain epitomized the hidebound Navy at its worst. He frowned at my drawing and backhanded my concept. We don't build submarines that look like that. He admitted that our test results were interesting, but added, your design would probably cost us 2 or 3 knots in speed. I countered, but why care about losing 3 knots when you are invisible to your enemy? He ignored me. This looks more like the Monitor or the Merrimack from the Civil War, he said. We'd never build a modern submarine that looked like that. I returned to Burbank with a renewed, healthy disdain for the Anchors Away crowd, but one of our engineers just back from a Pearl Harbor business trip mentioned to me that he had seen a catamaran-type ship that the Navy had built experimentally on the QT out of unauthorized funds. This was a prototype swath, small water area twin-hull ship, that was proving to be amazingly stable in heavy seas and was considerably faster than a conventional ship. It seemed to me that a catamaran swath ship held real promise as a model for a stealthy ship. And on my next trip to Washington for a meeting on our stealth airplane design with Defense Undersecretary Bill Perry, who was the Carter administration's czar of stealth, I mentioned the idea of a model stealth ship. I told Dr. Perry that the catamaran would provide a perfect test of the effects of stealth shaping and coatings for surface vessels. We also wanted to test the effects of seawater on radar-absorbing iron ferrite coatings. Dr. Perry agreed and ordered the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, to authorize a study contract with us. I put our best special projects engineer, Ugo Cody, in charge. DARPA had come up with $100,000, and I kicked in an additional $150,000 to begin developing a workable model catamaran. One of the biggest threats against our surface vessels was the Soviet RORS satellite, using powerful X-band radar. Shape was the key to defeating Soviet radar. Coatings accounted for only 10% effectiveness in deflecting radar. The rest was quietness of a vessel's engines and minimizing its wake. Ugo picked four other engineers for his team and set to work developing a swath ship model that sat on the water like a catamaran with a pair of underwater pontoon-type hulls that propelled the ship with twin screws. The underwater pontoons provided most of its buoyancy and good stability in rolling seas, and also produced very little wake. A ship's wake is as easy to spot from the sky as a fighter's contrail. Our ship was the most unconventional seagoing vessel ever to come off a drawing board. There was a definite family resemblance to our stealth fighter. Only the floating version had no wings. It was a series of severe flat planes at 45-degree angles that sat above the water on struts connected to a pair of submerged pontoons. The ship would be powered by the diesel-electric propulsion that drives electric generators. Cables carried the current to a pair of powerful electric motors in each submerged pontoon that spun counter-rotating propellers. Careful shaping of the pontoons and the propellers cut down sharply on noise and wake. This wasn't exactly a ship of classic design, but my hunch was that we could really fill an important niche in the Navy's defensive needs. NATO war games played out by computer had triggered alarm among the Navy brass about the vulnerability of our carrier task forces to enemy air attack. The premise of the game was that the Soviet Union had attacked Western Europe, and that the U.S. Navy had quickly reacted by steaming a backup carrier task force into the North Atlantic. Unfortunately, Soviet long-range fighter bombers using new look-down-shoot-down radar-guided missiles caused worrisome losses to our carriers and escorts in the computerized warfare exercise. To counter this threat, the Navy was crashing production of a billion-dollar missile frigate that would fire the new Aegis ground-to-air missiles designed to destroy incoming cruise missiles. I thought, why go after the arrows? Go after the shooter. To the chagrin of the billion-buck Aegis frigate backers, our swath boat would cost only $200 million. We could arm it with 64 Patriot-type missiles and send it out 300 miles ahead of the carrier task force as an invisible, amphibious SAM missile site. We'd shoot down the Soviet attack aircraft before they got in missile range of the fleet. And because they couldn't see the stealth ship electronically, they literally never know what hit them. We did an analysis and determined that the entire U.S. Navy carrier fleet could be protected by only 18 of our stealth defenders armed with SAMs. Since our ship would knock out most of the incoming air armada trying to attack our carriers, we would make the Aegis more effective by dramatically decreasing the number of incoming missiles it would be called upon to try to destroy at one time. And we had compelling test data to prove our contentions. To accurately measure the low radar cross-section of a model ship under realistic ocean conditions, Ugo Cody went to one of the most remote areas of the Western Desert. There, within hailing distance of Death Valley, he built himself a miniature ocean. The place was about 2 days from Edwards Air Force Base by mule pack or by jeep crawling through deeply rutted roads. It was an ancient lake bed sitting at the foot of an 8,500-foot mountain, on top of which Ugo planned to mount a radar system that would duplicate the Soviet radar satellites. Ugo's ocean was a 100-foot by 80-foot plastic swimming pool 8 inches deep. The model sat atop a 30-foot table that rocked and rolled to approximate a realistic ocean. The Soviet's X-band radar was hauled up the steep side of the mountain in a second-hand refrigerated meat truck that kept both the electronics and the operators from frying in the broiling sun. To get up the steep dirt incline, The truck had to be pushed by a bulldozer. The biggest problem we encountered was with the region's wild horses and mules, whose ancestors were the pack animals used by borax miners who dug in those mountains during the last century. The smell of water drew the wild herds to our make-believe ocean and interfered with our testing until one of our guys solved the problem by adding buckets of salt to our bogus ocean. Soviet spy satellites overflew once a day because the Navy used that desert range for missile testing, and the Russians must have wondered what in hell we were up to out there, stocking a pool near Death Valley for thirsty mules and horses. In the early fall of 1978, I took our test results to Bill Perry at the Pentagon. I reviewed with him all our tests and the low radar returns we had managed to achieve so far. He was enthusiastic and ordered the Navy to provide research and development funding for the creation of our prototype stealth ship. The ship would be called Sea Shadow. But I returned to Burbank with some anxieties about the mixed blessings of launching another stealth project while we were still struggling to build the first stealth airplane. We're currently updating our fleet of U-2s and producing SR-71 Blackbirds. I was thriving while our shipbuilding people in Northern California were laying off workers. That situation was not lost on the Ocean Division executives, who heard rumors about our secret stealth ship project and complained to the Lockheed top management that they needed this project one hell of a lot more than did the Skunk Works. I found myself suddenly under pressure to let go of the ship and send it northward. God, I hated to do it. But company politics and basic management considerations prompted me to go along and give up the ship project. I had a full plate without it, while my shipbuilding colleagues were scrambling to find business. I surrendered to the inevitable and turned over the project to the Ocean Division, but only after I convinced our CEO, Roy Anderson, to allow Ugo Cody and his team, who had done all the work on the ship in the test phase, to stay on as overseers of the actual construction. "We need Ugo to keep those damned shipbuilders from going off on a tangent," I told Roy Anderson. "This is one project where the method of shipbuilding is much less important than the stealth technology," I told Roy. "They'll want to sacrifice the stealth if it gets in the way of the ship's performance, but Ugo will force them to stay focused. All Dr. Perry wants to prove out is the stealth. That's key to this test. If the ship merely floats, that's good enough." As it happened, my fears about the conflicting agendas between professional shipbuilders and experts on stealth technology like Dr. Perry were realized almost from the first day that the Ocean Division took over the project. Ugo Cody did his best, but he ran into heavy weather. His original six-man operation quickly was shunted aside by 85 bureaucrats and paper pushers running the program for the division. Then the Navy marched in, adding its supervision and bureaucracy into the mix with a 50-man team of overseers who stood around or sat around creating reams of unread paperwork. No ship ever went to sea, not even a top-secret prototype, without intensive naval supervision to ensure that all ironclad naval rules and regulations were strictly enforced before the keel was ever laid. "Where is the paint locker?" a Navy commander demanded of Ugo, rattling the blueprint plans. "Since the days of John Paul Jones, every naval ship afloat has a damned paint locker on board. Sea Shadow would definitely not be the only exception since the Revolutionary War, and before she started her sea trials, a paint locker was located just below the bridge. Maintaining secrecy was another big headache. How do you build a 160-foot ship whose strange exotic appearance and shape are the keys to its secrecy, and keep that shape and appearance from the eyes of a small army of shipyard workers building it? The only logical answer was to build the ship in pieces, doling out 6 or 8 sections per shipyard, then assembling the pieces as a gigantic jigsaw puzzle inside a huge submergible barge located in Redwood City, California. Sea Shadow was made of very strong welded steel, displaced 560 tons, and was 70 feet wide. During early sea trials in 1981, we suffered unexpectedly large wakes that were easy to spot on radar and from the air, which completely baffled us until we discovered that the motor propellers had been installed backward. Our ship had a 4-man crew, commander, helmsman, navigator, and engineer. By contrast, a frigate doing a similar job had more than 300 crewmen. Viewed from head-on, the ship looked like Darth Vader's helmet. Some Navy brass who saw her clenched their teeth in disgust at the sight of the most futuristic ship ever to ply the seas. A future commander resented having only a 4-man crew to boss around on a ship that was so secret that the Navy could not even admit it existed. Our stealth ship might be able to blast out of the sky a sizable Soviet attack force, but in terms of an officer's future status and promotion prospects, it was about as glamorous as commanding a tugboat. At the highest levels, the Navy brass was equally unenthusiastic about the small number of stealth ships they would need to defend carrier task forces. Too few to do anyone's career much good in terms of power or prestige. The carrier task force people didn't like the stealth ship because it reminded everyone how vulnerable their hulking ships really were. But by the fall of 1982, when Britain and Argentina began hostilities around the Falkland Islands, the Sea Shadow won renewed attention at the Pentagon. The British reported success using primitive ferrite-coated nets hung over the masts and radar antennas of their warships to lower their radar cross-section against air attack. Even the QE-2, which was drafted as a troop transport, used these anti-radar nets. The Brits claimed to have lowered their radar cross-section by an order of magnitude. But their results weren't one-quarter as impressive as ours. A typical warship was a very high reflector of radar, a radar profile equal to about 50 barns. Our frigate would show up a hell of a lot smaller than a dinghy. By the time we were ready for full-scale testing in the early summer of 1985, the Navy was eager to subject our prototype to the most rigorous radar testing imaginable. Several of their radar experts claimed that there was no way we could duplicate the low radar cross-section achieved by a 30-foot model in a pool with a full-size prototype on the real ocean. We had heard those same skeptical predictions before from the Air Force over our stealth airplane. But in the wonderful world of stealth, once we had acquired the right shape, the size of an object really didn't matter. The military had a tough time understanding that basic fact. The barge, with Sea Shadow cocooned inside for secrecy, was towed from Sunnyvale in Northern California down to Long Beach to begin its tests in the dead of night off Santa Cruz Island, where we had constructed a radar installation. We sailed our ship against the most advanced Navy Hunter planes. To make certain that their radar detectors were functioning by the book, we placed submarine periscopes in the ocean at the nautical mile range where the plane's onboard radar would first be expected to detect them. The radar worked predictably, picking up the radar signature of the periscope at the expected range. Then the airplanes flew on, seeking our ship. On one typical night of testing, the Navy sub-Hunter airplanes made 57 passes at us and detected the ship only twice, both times at a mile-and-a-half distance, so that we would have shot them down easily long before they spotted us. Several times we actually provided the exact location to the pilots, and they still could not pick us up on their radar. These kinds of tests went on for nearly a year, and often were conducted under the scrutiny of Soviet trawlers snooping in the open seas off the Channel Islands about 60 miles southwest of Santa Barbara. To keep local fishing boats and any curious yachtsmen away, the Coast Guard leaked the word that they were escalating stop-and-search procedures against potential drug smugglers in the ship lanes we were using. Boat traffic miraculously vanished. The tests began an hour after sunset and lasted until an hour before sunrise. Then Sea Shadow was docked inside the barge and tugged back to Long Beach. But the long, strenuous months of testing confirmed most of our original stealth predictions. One of the biggest problems we had to overcome was our own extreme invisibility. The ocean waves showed up on radar like a string of tracer bullets. And if the ship was totally invisible, it looked like a blank spot, like a hole in the donut that was a dead giveaway. In the stealth business, you tried like the devil not to be quieter than the background noise, because that was like a trumpet blast warning to the enemy. By the time we solved this problem, however, the admirals who ran the surface fleet were displaying little enthusiasm for going any speed ahead. Too radical a design, they told me. If the ship is so revolutionary and secret, how could we ever use it without hundreds of sailors seeing it? It's just too far out. There were sexier ways of spending naval appropriations than on a small secret ship that would win few political brownie points for any admiral who pushed for it. Although the Navy did apply our technology to lower the cross-section of submarine periscopes and reduce the radar cross-section of their new class of destroyers, we were dry-docked before we had really got launched. So I held back. I had a design for a stealthy aircraft carrier that would show up on radar no bigger than a life raft. But I had already proven Kelly's unwritten Rule 15 about dealing with the Navy. Why ignore it twice? 14. The Long Goodbye. In the early summer of 1972, an executive of Northrop Aircraft Company, whom I'll call Fred Lawrence, invited me to dinner and offered me a terrific job. "Ben," he said, "we are planning to build a lightweight single-engine fighter. We've never done a single-engine jet before, and we want you to set up a skunk works for us, with you as our Kelly Johnson." "Why me?" I asked, truly amazed. I could think of three or four veterans of our skunk works who had a world of managerial and practical experience, greater than my own. For openers, our vice president, Russ Daniel, had been a project manager before I was even hired at Lockheed, and on the basis of seniority would certainly appear to be more qualified than I was. I was then 47 years old, working as Kelly's assistant chief engineer in charge of aerodynamics and all the flight sciences. I had about 45 people working for me, and was earning $60,000. I was doing dandy without any real future aspirations. "Why you?" Fred Lawrence smiled, repeating my question. "Because you've got the temperament and background we've been looking for. You're Kelly's troubleshooter on the technical side, which is recommendation enough. We need you to make sure we get the right propulsion system to fit performance capability. That's 80% of the battle, am I right? How many prototypes go down the toilet because the engine is underpowered or totally wrong for what the designers want to achieve? You won't let that happen. You have a solid reputation for being a straight shooter, and customers like you. Ben, with you on board, we think we can do big things in the fighter market." He explained that they wanted to go after the cheaper, lighter airplanes for the NATO and Asian markets, and had plans in the works to prototype an advanced Air Force interceptor. "We want a piece of that fighter market," he said, "and you can help us grab it. You know that won't happen at the Skunk Works as long as Kelly is in charge. The Air Defense Command crosses the street when they see him coming. He's just too big a pain in the ass to work with. You know I'm telling it right. Ben, break out and come with us. Be your own man. I'm telling you, you won't regret it. We'll do big things together." I didn't trust Lawrence, but the job he was offering represented the kind of personal challenge that I lived for. Over coffee, he told me that whatever salary Kelly was currently paying me, Northrop was willing to better it by $10,000 annually. I promised them a decision in a week. My wife, Faye, was no help. She said, "Ben, only you can decide what to do. It is up to you." The truth was that I was tempted to grab the job, but dreaded having to confront Kelly with my decision. In the past 6 years, he had taken me under his wing, putting me up for various professional awards for my work on the Blackbird's revolutionary moving spike inlets, encouraging me to write technical papers for aeronautical journals to increase my name recognition within the industry. The curse of operating inside a top-secret world is that very few in the aerospace industry knew you even existed. I also had talked Kelly into letting me attend a 13-week management training course at Harvard's Business School in the summer of 1969. It was an advanced management institute for about 150 carefully selected, upwardly mobile executives, and Kelly wrote me a glowing recommendation that helped me get in and authorized Lockheed to pay the tuition freight, which was considerable. He backed me even though he insisted that it would be a complete waste of my time. I'll teach you all you need to know about running a company in one afternoon, and we'll both go home early to boot. You don't need Harvard to teach you that it's more important to listen than to talk. You can get straight A's from all your Harvard profs, but you'll never make the grade unless you are decisive. Even a timely wrong decision is better than no decision. The final thing you'll need to know is don't half-heartedly wound problems. Kill them dead. That's all there is to it. Now you can run this goddamn place. Now go on home and pour yourself a drink. But I had persisted, and when I returned from Cambridge wearing a new crimson tie, Kelly asked me for my appraisal of the Harvard Business School. To accommodate him, I wrote out an equation. 2/3 of HBS equals BS. He roared with laughter, had my equation framed, and gave it back to me for Christmas. Kelly let me test my Harvard training by putting me in charge of an elite skunkworks team of engineers and designers that he loaned to Lockheed's main plant for 6 months, just down the street from our Burbank headquarters, in the fall of 1969, to help them build 5 prototypes for a new carrier-based Navy submarine hunting airplane. He could spare us, because our own business was unusually slack. Between the new Blackbird and the older U-2, the Air Force had all the spy planes it could use, and that was our house specialty. Northrop's Fred Lawrence was correct. The Blue Suiters, who controlled fighter procurements, didn't think of us as fighter builders anymore. Our last fighter was the Mach 2 F-104 Starfighter, built during the Korean War to match the fastest Russian MiGs. But for more than a decade, we had been seldom included in the bids sent out from the Pentagon announcing a competition for a new fighter. Lockheed as a corporation had a booming business in cargo aircraft and missiles for the Navy, but the Skunk Works had to lay off about 1,100 workers. And the open secret, which several of us inside the Skunk Works realized but never openly discussed out of loyalty to the boss, was that the Blue Suiters in charge of fighters had blackballed Kelly Johnson and excluded him and us from fighter competition because they found him too contentious and bullying to work with any longer. So I really felt rotten when I finally worked up the courage to inform Kelly about Northrop's offer to start up a fighter project. In his dealings with me, he appreciated the fact that I always provided him with alternatives when presenting him with a problem. I'd say, solution one will cost you so much money, solution two will cost you so much time. You're the boss, which do you choose? So often, others would come to him like errant schoolboys and moan, Kelly, bad news, we broke that part. And he'd get sore and shout, well, what in the hell do you expect me to do about it? Now I had no alternative to offer for the course of action I was taking. I was walking out on him. During the time I spent at the main plant on the Navy Subhunter project, Russ Daniel had to suddenly step into the breach and take over in place of Kelly, who was hospitalized with a serious abdominal infection. That brief stint running the Skunk Works for a couple of months in 1970 proved to be a personal disaster for Russ. He had signed off on a project proposal for the Air Force that included a glaring mathematical error. The Pentagon analysts who discovered the mistake couldn't resist rubbing our noses in it, and a 2-star general, who had probably waited for years to stick it to Kelly and his know-it-alls in Burbank, phoned him in his hospital room and raised hell about our sloppy work. Kelly was livid and ordered me back to the Skunk Works immediately to take charge of the technical section. Russ Daniel had to obtain my approval on all technical matters. Since he was a vice president and the odds-on favorite to be Kelly's successor, I'm sure he wasn't delighted with that arrangement. But he handled it gracefully. From then on, when there was a critical meeting about deadlines or problems or an angry customer in Kelly's office, I would be sent for to sit in, sometimes with Russ, but more often without him. Kelly and I had grown close. He had lost his wife Althea in the fall of 1970 after a long struggle with cancer. She was his age and had been his secretary years earlier. Before she died, Althea told Kelly that he needed to remarry without much delay, because he was not the kind of man who could live alone. She worried about his drinking and poor eating habits when left to himself. I think you should marry Mary Ellen, Althea told him. Mary Ellen Mead was Kelly's secretary. She was a vivacious redhead, 25 years younger than both of the Johnsons, and had recently suffered a messy divorce. She had started her Skunkworks career several years earlier as my secretary, and both my wife and I got to know her well and were fond of her. She was in awe of Kelly and very devoted to him. About 6 weeks after Althea's funeral, Kelly sent for me. He seemed embarrassed and troubled, and I knew he was in a real quandary when he began confiding his personal problems, something very much out of character. But he told me about Althea's deathbed wish that he marry Mary Ellen, and wondered what people would think if he carried out that wish anytime soon. He fretted over the age difference and how awkward it would be if Mary Ellen refused him. My heart went out to him. "Kelly," I said, "since when do you worry about what people think? All that matters is what you think. No one around here will think you're a dirty old man, if that's what you're worrying about. We'll all be secretly jealous as hell. I don't have the slightest doubt that Mary Ellen could make you very happy." He thanked me and proposed to Mary Ellen a few days later. When the couple returned from their Hawaiian honeymoon in June 1970, he began inviting Faye and me to join them for dinner or to be weekend guests at Kelly's 1,200-acre cattle ranch near Ronald Reagan's Big Spread overlooking Solvang, California. Kelly had seldom socialized with any employees, except at occasional company functions or, even more rarely, asking a couple of guys to join him for a quick round of golf at a local country club, where Kelly would breeze through 18 holes using only a 6-iron, which he claimed was just fine for all shots near and far. He was so muscle-bound from having been a hod carrier as a kid that his golf swing for distance was quite limited, but he was a skilled putter until occasional swigs from his back pocket flask got the best of his aim. I was not a golfer, but I adored Chinese food, and when Kelly discovered we had a mutual passion, my wife and I began joining him and his new bride for weekly Chinese culinary outings at favorite restaurants. Kelly seemed to be genuinely happy with Mary Ellen and eager to show her off. She even got Kelly to give up drinking scotch because she hated the smell on his breath. He began drinking vodka instead. Faye and I would be invited to accompany the newlyweds on the Lockheed jet on weekend trips to the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado, or to aeronautical conventions in other picturesque places, where he gave a speech and then introduced his very attractive new wife with obvious pride and affection. "Mary Ellen loves Faye," he confided to me, "and I think it's about time that the right people in this business get to meet you, too." But just around the time that Northrop approached me in 1972 on the new job, Mary Ellen began getting sick, seriously sick. She was a diabetic and didn't really take care of herself. Her diabetes became a monster unleashed, and she never was able to catch up with it. She developed kidney problems, then her eyesight began to fail. Kelly was heartsick, but outside of myself and Norm Nelson, no one else at work was aware of the extent of Mary Ellen's illness. When she learned of Faye's sudden death in late 1980, she was devastated. By then, she weighed about 80 pounds. She said to me, "Oh, Ben, Faye was so much stronger and healthier than I. What hope can there be for me?" She died a few weeks later. She was only 38 years old. Before she died, she advised Kelly to marry her best friend, Nancy Horrigan, which he did, soon after Mary Ellen's funeral, and after again consulting with me about what people might think, which was probably just another way for him to discover what I thought. I told him, "Kelly, do it. You need a good woman in your life. Mary Ellen had only your best interests at heart." I told Kelly about Northrop's offer on a day when he was leaving early to go with Mary Ellen to the hospital for tests that would ultimately reveal her need for a kidney transplant. When I discovered how unfortunate my timing was, I felt dreadful. I could tell he was worried and preoccupied, but I had no choice but to push ahead and blurt it out. "Kelly," I said, "you've been like a father to me. I love it here. I love the work and the people and the uniqueness of this place. But this is a golden opportunity." I laid out Northrop's offer, and he closed his eyes and solemnly shook his head. "God damn it, Ben. I don't believe a word that guy said to you. I'll bet my ranch against Northrop starting its own Skunk Works. Companies give it lip service because we've been so successful running ours. The bottom line is that most managements don't trust the idea of an independent operation, where they hardly know what in hell is going on and are kept in the dark because of security. Don't kid yourself. A few among our own people resent the hell out of me and our independence. And even those in aerospace who respect our work know damned well that the fewer people working on a project, the less profit from big government contracts and cost overruns. And keeping things small cuts down on raises and promotions. Hell, in the main plant, they give raises on the basis of the more people being supervised,